Look at the sugar packet on your table right now. Or, you know, maybe think about that sweet treat you have sitting in your pantry.
Right.
Take a quick mental inventory of it. It looks completely innocent, doesn't it? I mean, it's uniform, it's white, it's clean. It is practically weightless.
Yeah, real deal.
You just tear open that little paper tube, you pour it into your morning coffee, give it a quick stir, and it just dissolves. It disappears. The only trace left behind is, well, just the pleasure of the sweetness.
Exactly.
But what if that tiny weightless crystal is actually a masterclass in hiding the true cost of our modern convenience? What if the very act of dissolving so seamlessly is part of this incredibly sophisticated centuries-old illusion?
That's the exact question we have to ask.
Today, we are going to look at the massive, world-altering history hidden inside that little crystal. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is exploring some truly fascinating and frankly pretty sobering research by Dr. Bechara Saheli.
It's incredible work.
It really is. We are looking at a scholarly monograph titled The Sweetness That Consumed the World, Sugar, Plantation Modernity, and the Long Metabolic Afterlife of Empire. And I want to set expectations for you right off the bat. We are not just doing a botanical history of a plant today.
No, definitely not.
We're not just talking about how to grow sugarcane. This is an investigation into how the sugar crystal literally became the blueprint for modern global organization. We're going to unpack how a simple, hardwired, biological human desire for sweetness was essentially hijacked.
Hijacked and weaponized, really.
Right. It was used to completely re-engineer land, labor, law, finance, and even our modern industrial diets. And I have to say, getting into this material completely broke my brain on a few fronts.
I can imagine. It challenges a lot of assumptions.
It totally does. Because when I hear the word plantation, I realize I have always had this very, like, cartoonish cinematic idea in my head. I picture this archaic, old-timey, inefficient, almost medieval farm, just a big piece of land run by people stuck in the past.
Yeah, and that is such a common misconception. But the reality of the Caribbean plantation was the absolute opposite of an archaic farm. That is one of the most crucial initial hurdles you have to get over when engaging with this work.
Okay, so how should we be thinking about it?
Well, the text synthesizes this right away through a concept called plantation modernity. The Caribbean plantation, particularly as it developed in the 17th and 18th centuries, was a highly sophisticated, financially integrated, and legally complex global machine.
A machine.
Exactly. It wasn't a step backward into some dark age of agricultural feudalism. It was a technologically adaptive, globally networked institution. You really have to think of it more like the prototype for the modern multinational corporation.
Wow, okay. A prototype for a multinational corporation in what, the 1600s?
Yes, precisely. It joined relentless commercial calculation with a brutal system of racial domination.
Yeah.
And it did so in a way that was incredibly coherent from an administrative standpoint. We have to completely discard that with the wind imagery and start seeing the plantation as an integrated agro-industrial complex.
So it wasn't just a big farm.
Not at all. It was a system that meticulously coordinated land management, heavy industrial technology, and human life. For one singular purpose, distant, scalable accumulation of wealth.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really grasp how successful that machine was, the source actually starts us at the end of the production line.
Right, with the consumer.
Exactly. It starts with the finished commodity, that innocent-looking sugar sitting on our tables, to show us how that innocence isn't a natural state. It is a deliberately manufactured illusion. And the book introduces this concept that I just found haunting. It calls it sacrificial sweetness.
Sacrificial sweetness is such a profound theoretical framing. It basically describes a systemic arrangement where pleasure and abundance are made incredibly affordable and accessible for one group of people, specifically by transferring the horrific human, ecological, and social costs of that pleasure onto others.
And the key to that transfer is that the people enjoying it don't see the cost, right?
Exactly. The key mechanism is invisibility. The people bearing the cost are completely excluded from the consumer's view. The consumer gets the sweetness, the laborer, and the landscape bear the sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And the physical product itself, the sugar crystal, is the perfect vehicle for this invisibility.
That part completely blew my mind. The physical process of making sugar is literally a metaphor for this social erasure.
It really is.
I mean, think about it. To make refined sugar, you take this massive, fibrous, heavy green cane stalk, you crush it, you boil it, you strip away the water, you strip away the plant fiber, you use charcoal and bone char to strip away the natural brown molasses color until you are left with this pure, white, abstracted crystal.
And Dr. Sevely points out that this physical abstraction completely mirrors the social abstraction.
Right.
By the time that crystal sits in a silver bowl in a London drawing room in the 1700s, or, you know, on our peach encounter today, the history of the labor, the violence of the overseer, the ecological destruction of the island soil, all of it has been physically and chemically stripped away from the final product.
So the clearer the crystal, the less it tells you about the brutal labor conditions of its origin.
Precisely. The physical properties of the commodity protect the consumer's conscience. And this leads us to what is arguably the most vital concept in the entire monograph, which is the displaced balance sheet.
Okay, yes, the displaced balance sheet. This is huge.
It is. If we look at conventional corporate accounting, a balance sheet looks balanced only because you record the costs and revenues that the institution legally chooses to recognize.
Right.
On a colonial sugar ledger, the revenues, the profits, the tax gains for the European state, the merchant incomes for them, those all travel smoothly toward legally protected ownership.
But the true cost of production are left entirely off the page.
Completely off the page. The unpaid labor of the enslaved, the bodily injuries from the machinery, the family ruptures caused by selling people, the premature deaths from exhaustion, the total depletion of the island's topsoil. Those are real, tangible costs.
But they are displaced.
Yes, they remain geographically and legally trapped with the people and the territories that have absolutely no power to transfer them onto the commercial ledger.
You know, I was thinking about this in terms of our modern gig economy or like digital supply chains.
That's a great comparison.
It's like clicking next day delivery on our smartphones. We get this massive dopamine hit when the package magically arrives on our porch the next morning. It feels totally frictionless. But the algorithm completely hides the reality.
The reality of the labor, yeah.
Right. It hides the exhausted warehouse workers peeing in bottles to meet quotas, the intense logistics strain, the massive carbon footprint of the cargo planes, the traffic accidents caused by rush delivery drivers. We don't see any of that. We just see the cardboard box. So the displaced balance sheet of the sugar plantation is basically the original brutally intensified version of externalizing costs.
The modern parallels are highly relevant, because the architecture of externalized costs was really pioneered here. The system did not require everyday consumers in Europe, the people stirring sugar into their tea, to be intentionally cruel, malicious people.
They didn't have to be villains.
Right. It merely required them not to look too closely. Guilt is fragmented perfectly across the entire supply chain.
So everyone just does their little part.
Exactly. The consumer just buys a sweetener from the grocer. The state just regulates the maritime trade and collects tariffs. The underwriter in London just prices the maritime risk of the cargo. And the planter in the Caribbean just manages the daily output of the estate.
Everyone is just doing their narrow bureaucratic job.
Yes. The market price of sugar in a European shop represented a real calculation of shipping, duties, and milling equipment, but it was fundamentally a false price.
False because it left out the human cost.
Right. It entirely omitted the uncompensated labor and the destroyed futures of the captive workforce. The cheapness of sugar was not a product of natural efficiency. It was a political achievement.
Wow, a political achievement.
It was based entirely on deciding whose lives actually counted on the ledger and whose lives were legally invisible.
Okay, so because the crystal is so good at hiding its origins, we have to look backward. Where did this plant actually come from? Because another thing that surprised me, the Caribbean didn't invent sugar.
No, not at all.
The colonizers imported it. We're talking about an ancient plant that got transported across the world and, as you said earlier, weaponized.
If we trace the deep botanical and cultural roots of sugarcane, we find ourselves looking at indigenous agricultural knowledge in New Guinea and Southeast Asia.
So that's where it all started.
Yes. For centuries, perhaps thousands of years, cane was grown and selected for its size and sweetness. But it was primarily consumed locally. It was chewed for immediate hydration and a quick burst of energy.
So you just cut it down and chew the stalk.
Exactly. It was a local, ecologically grounded relationship. You grow it, you cut it, you chew it. The sweetness was tied to the physical plant itself.
And it didn't stay there. It started moving westward, right, through human migration and trade.
It did. As the plant traveled through human exchange into South Asia and eventually the broader Islamic world, we see a massive evolution in the technologies surrounding the juice.
What kind of technology?
Well, it was in these societies that sophisticated techniques for large-scale irrigation, specialized boiling, and eventually crystallization were developed.
And crystallization is the big game changer, right?
It was the massive technological leap. Before crystallization, sugarcane juice would just spoil. It was heavy, wet, and highly perishable.
You couldn't exactly put juice on a ship for 3 months.
Exactly. But once you could boil it down and coax it into forming a stable dry crystal, everything changes. The sweetness is now abstracted from the heavy plant. It becomes shelf stable.
It becomes a product.
A product that can be stored for years, divided into standardized weights, and traded over massive distances. The technology of crystallization turned a local agricultural product into a global currency.
And when it finally reaches Europe via the Crusaders coming back from the Middle East and through Mediterranean trade networks, it wasn't an everyday food. You couldn't just go buy a bag of it at the store.
No, it was incredibly rare.
It was treated almost like a rare spice from the Orient. The book notes that doctors used it as a medicine to mask the taste of bitter remedies.
Yes, it was highly medicinal at first.
And then there's the whole status symbol aspect of it, which is just wild. Wealthy European elites would have these massive, elaborate, sculpted sugar displays at banquets, castles, and swans made entirely of sugar.
They were called subtleties.
Right. And it wasn't even meant to be eaten. It was just a centerpiece to show off how absurdly rich you were.
At that point in European history, sugar was a pure language of hierarchy. Consuming it, or merely displaying it, proved you had access to expensive, long-distance luxury trade networks.
That makes sense.
But what the source heavily emphasizes here is the historical separation between knowledge and recognition.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, European colonizers and merchants eventually appropriated highly complex agricultural, hydraulic, and processing science from Asian, Islamic, and indigenous worlds. They learned how to build the waterworks, how to manage the boiling temperatures, how to cure the crystals.
They took the technology.
Yes, but centuries later, official colonial archives and European histories would frame this massive agro-industrial success in the Americas as a triumph of European ingenuity and civilization.
Just completely erasing the non-European origins of the science and the technology.
Exactly. A total erasure of where the knowledge actually came from.
This brings me to a massive question I had while reading, and here's where it gets really interesting for me. If European empires already had sugar growing in places closer to home, the book mentions the Mediterranean.
Yes, Cyprus and Crete.
Right. Places like Cyprus, Crete, and eventually early Atlantic islands off the coast of Africa, like Madeira and Sao Tome, the text calls these island laboratories.
That's right.
Where early colonizers tested out combining sugar crops with merchant capital and coerced labor. So if they already had this going on in the Mediterranean and the Eastern Atlantic, why completely upend the Caribbean?
It's a great question.
Why move an entire massive heavy industry thousands of miles across an ocean? That just seems incredibly inefficient and dangerous, especially given the naval technology of the time.
The jump across the Atlantic was driven by the severe ecological limits of the Mediterranean and the insatiable demand of the emerging capitalist market.
Ecological limits, meaning they ran out of resources.
Yes. Sugar processing is incredibly resource intensive. It requires immense amounts of fuel for the boiling houses. You have to keep massive fires burning 24 hours a day during the harvest to boil down the cane juice.
So they needed a ton of wood.
Massive amounts of wood. It also requires vast amounts of fresh water for irrigation and running mills. The Mediterranean environments, particularly on relatively small islands, faced rapid fuel depletion.
They just chopped down all the trees.
They were literally chopping down every tree in sight to feed the boiling houses, which led to deforestation and soil erosion. They also faced severe water scarcity.
And what about the labor side of things?
Right. Furthermore, the emerging capitalist networks in Europe had an insatiable demand for scalable land and, crucially, a captive labor force that could be relentlessly exploited without local political blowback.
Ah, so you couldn't just enslave the locals in the Mediterranean?
No, you couldn't easily enslave the local population in the Mediterranean without sparking massive, complex geopolitical conflict.
With the Ottoman Empire or other powers, right?
Exactly. So the Mediterranean and the early Atlantic islands were essentially the rehearsals. There were beta tests for the plantation model. The Caribbean, however, offered vast appropriable lands, a climate perfectly suited to the crop, and crucial distance from European oversight.
So it was the perfect storm for this industry to just explode.
It became the site for the industrial scale performance.
And that geographical leap across the Atlantic triggered what Dr. Saley calls the sugar revolution. And the book makes it very clear that this wasn't just a shift in what farmers decided to plant one spring. It was a total violent societal reorganization.
Complete reorganization.
The source uses St. Kitts and Barbados in the early to mid 17th century as the prime examples of this. Before sugar really took hold, what were these colonies doing? The book mentions they were heavily dependent on tobacco.
Tobacco was the foundational cash crop for many early Caribbean colonies. And the socioeconomic structure of tobacco cultivation is vastly different from sugar.
How so?
Well, tobacco could be cultivated by smallholders. It requires labor, certainly, and it is a cash crop. But a modest European settler could clear a few acres, plant tobacco, harvest it, dry it in a relatively simple shed, and pack it for shipping.
So it's pretty simple, low barrier to entry.
Exactly. It did not require massive heavy infrastructure. The society was consequently made up of a relatively large number of small to medium-sized European landowners, utilizing indentured servants, and a smaller number of enslaved Africans.
But then sugar comes in and changes all of that.
Entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of a concept the source defines as the capital threshold.
Right. I really want to dig into this capital threshold because it's the turning point. With tobacco, you pick it and dry it, but you can't just harvest sugarcane, throw it in the hull of a ship, and send it to London. It doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. Sugarcane begins to ferment and rot almost immediately after it is severed from the root. The biological clock starts ticking the second the machete hits the stalk.
So you're racing against time.
You are. It must be crushed, its juice clarified, and boiled very quickly, usually within 24 to 48 hours. Otherwise, the entire crop is lost to fermentation.
Wow, that is a tight window.
It is. This biological reality meant a sugar plantation could not just be an agricultural field. It had to be a fully integrated industrial works. You couldn't just grow it. You had to process it on site.
And that requires serious gear.
Exactly. Processing required heavy, precision engineered mills with massive iron rollers to crush the cane. It required massive boiling houses with huge imported copper vats. It required specialized curing structures for the molasses to drain.
Just a massive amount of infrastructure.
And fleets of carts and massive herds of livestock to turn the mills if wind or water power wasn't available, and to transport the heavy hogsheads of sugar to the port. The cost to build, maintain, and operate this infrastructure created a massive capital threshold.
So the barrier to entry was astronomical.
Astronomical. If you were a small tobacco farmer, you simply could not afford to build a sugar mill. And if you didn't have a mill, you couldn't grow sugar.
So what does this all mean for the people who are already living there? It seems like this specific technology, the necessity of the heavy mill, actually forced the entire society to become radically more unequal.
That is a very astute observation. Technology itself is not inherently destiny, but within the specific institutional framework of colonial capitalism, the heavy machinery of the mill drove massive, rapid inequality.
Because the small guys just got squeezed out?
Because of the incredibly high cost of entry, wealthy planters, those who had backing from London merchants, began consolidating land. They bought up, or aggressively pushed out, the smaller European tobacco farmers.
So the landscape completely changes.
The land transformed from a patchwork of small holdings to massive, sprawling mega estates owned by a few incredibly wealthy families.
And what happens to the labor force when these estates get that big?
As these estates grew, and as the machinery grew larger, the demand for continuous, grueling, deeply dangerous labor skyrocketed. The European indentured servant model, which had sustained the tobacco era, completely collapsed under the demands of sugar.
They just couldn't get enough people to do it.
There simply weren't enough European servants willing or able to do the work, and their contracts eventually expired. The planters demanded a labor force that was permanent, inheritable, and entirely deprived of legal rights to resist the horrific conditions.
So the capital threshold leads directly to chattel slavery.
It directly drove the massive forced importation of enslaved Africans. The demographic flip of the Caribbean from majority European to overwhelmingly enslaved African was intentionally engineered to feed the voracious appetite of the machinery.
Which leads to one of the darkest framing shifts in the book. It frames the Middle Passage, the horrific transatlantic journey of enslaved Africans, not just as a tragic transportation method, but as a literal extension of the plantation's production line.
It is a devastating but analytically necessary way to view it. The Middle Passage was essentially the reproductive system of the plantation economy.
Because they couldn't sustain the population locally?
The labor conditions on these Caribbean sugar estates were so lethal. Between the sheer danger of the milling machinery, the infernal heat and burns in the boiling houses, systemic malnutrition, tropical diseases, and absolute physical exhaustion, human life was consumed at a staggering rate.
The death rate was higher than the birth rate.
Far exceeded it. Instead of creating conditions where a workforce could survive, raise families, and reproduce naturally, which would require lowering production quotas and investing in human welfare, the system treated captive human beings as disposable commercial replacements.
So on the ledger, they were just another input.
The ledgers treated them as inputs that naturally depreciated and needed to be restocked. They imported life explicitly to consume it for profit.
And on a macro level, this obsession with sugar, this monoculture where they devoted almost every single inch of viable, arable land to cane, made these islands incredibly wealthy in terms of export value, but incredibly fragile as societies.
Fragile is the right word.
I mean, they were exporting massive, unimaginable commercial wealth back to Europe. The planters were becoming the richest men in the British Empire. But locally, the islands became entirely nutritionally dependent on imported food.
Because all the good land was taken.
Right. All the best soil was given to the cane. They engineered a system that produced total abundance for the global market and chronic scarcity for the actual people living on the island.
It's the ultimate perversion of agriculture.
Exactly. You grow a crop you can't live on to buy food from 1,000 miles away just so someone across the ocean can have sweetener in their tea.
And to truly understand how this relentless throughput was achieved, how they kept this massive machine running, despite the human cost we have to zoom in, we have to move away from the macroeconomics of the sugar revolution and look inside the perimeter of the estate itself.
We need to see how it actually operated day to day.
Yes. We need to examine the microscopic daily horror, the intense administrative control, and the forms of resistance on the ground.
Section 4 of the outline focuses on exactly this, the inner workings of the plantation machine. And the sequence of this machine is just chilling. It starts in the field. The source describes gang labor.
Gang labor, yes.
It wasn't just people working at their own pace. The labor was organized in these highly disciplined, almost militaristic gangs to impose strict, relentless geometry on the cane field. They moved in lines, swinging machetes in rhythm.
It was designed to maximize efficiency and control.
And then you move to the mill, which just sounds utterly terrifying. The source notes the constant everyday risks of amputation.
Amputation was horrifyingly common.
The workers, often exhausted and sleep-deprived, had to feed the tough cane stalks into these massive crushing rollers. And if a worker's hand or arm got caught in the rollers, the machinery did not have an emergency stop button.
No, the wind or the water or the animals kept pushing.
The machine demanded continuous feeding, and it didn't care what it crushed.
Exactly. And from the mill, the juice flows into the boiling house, which reads like a description of an absolute inferno. Extreme heat, thick smoke, boiling vats of sticky liquid, and people working extended night shifts in the dark just to keep the sugar from spoiling.
It's like Dante's Inferno, but for profit.
It was a perfectly integrated, nightmarish apparatus, and the pace of this entire machine was driven by the tyranny of what was called crop time.
Crop time? What exactly did that mean for the workers?
Well, as we discussed, because the cane ferments so quickly once cut, its biological perishability was entirely weaponized by the planters and overseers. They used the natural, rapid decay of the plant as an excuse for manufactured emergencies.
So everything is always a crisis.
Yes. It provided the ultimate justification for extending shifts deep into the night and implementing intense, brutal labor discipline.
The plant itself becomes the taskmaster.
The plant's biology dictated the schedule, and the schedule dictated the limits of human endurance. If the cane had to be boiled, the humans had to stay awake and keep the fires burning, regardless of exhaustion, sickness, or injury.
The machine comes first.
The mechanical and chemical needs of the production process totally superseded the biological needs of the human beings operating it.
But one of the most important aspects of this research is that it doesn't just portray the enslaved people as passive cogs being crushed by this machine.
No, and that's vital to highlight.
The book heavily highlights the concept of the counterplantation. When we think of resistance to slavery, we usually think of violent revolt. And obviously that happened. There were massive armed uprisings. But the counterplantation was about everyday life making in the shadow of the machine.
Yes. Survival as resistance.
The enslaved people created what were called provision grounds. They would take the marginal land on the edges of the estate, the rocky hillsides or the gullies that the planters couldn't use for cane, and they grew their own food. Yams, plantains, root vegetables.
It was a parallel economy.
Right. But it wasn't just about food. They established hidden, informal markets to trade this food. They held nocturnal gatherings. They preserved African languages and religions. They practiced their own spiritual and botanical healing outside the view of the plantation doctor.
The provision ground is one of the most fascinating and complex paradoxes of the entire plantation system.
How so?
Well, on one hand, the plantation owners allowed, or rather actively forced, enslaved people to grow their own food on their time off on Sundays. This was a massive subsidy to the estate.
So the owners didn't have to pay to feed them.
Exactly. By forcing the enslaved to feed themselves on marginal lands, the owner largely got out of the financial burden of paying for adequate imported rations. The worker absorbed the cost of their own basic survival.
That is incredibly twisted.
But on the other hand, the enslaved workers transformed these small plots into a vital sphere of autonomy. It became a physical space of cultural preservation, of independent economic exchange at Sunday markets, and of deep psychological resistance.
It's like a world within a world.
It represents a totally fundamentally different view of the human body and the person. The plantation machine viewed the enslaved body purely as an instrument of production, a tool that converts calories into labor.
Right, just a machine part.
In that view, pain is dismissed as malingering, and fatigue is treated as a threat to the schedule. The counterplantation, rooted in the provision grounds, viewed the body as a site of humanity, of kinship, of memory, and of futurity.
I really love how the source points out that if you just listen to the historical sounds of the plantation, it tells this exact story of two warring systems.
The sonic landscape is incredibly revealing.
Yeah, on one side, during the day, you have the overseer's bell ringing to mandate the start of the shift. You have the crack of the whip. You have the squeal of the mill rollers. Those are the sounds of the mechanical schedule dictating the throughput of the factory.
The noise of the machine.
But on the other side, at night, from the edges of the estate, you have the sounds of the drums, you have the songs, you have the coded communication and the storytelling of the enslaved community fighting back with a distinctly human rhythm.
It's the sound of the machine versus the sound of life.
Exactly.
That sonic contrast perfectly illustrates a vital normative standard that Dr. Salient introduces in the text, the concept of life coherence.
Life coherence. Let's dig into that.
An institution or system is life coherent if its internal logic protects, restores, or enlarges the capacities for living beings, human and ecological, to flourish.
Okay, so does it support life or destroy it?
The plantation machine was, technically speaking, highly efficient. It produced massive amounts of sugar and generated unprecedented profits. But it was fundamentally, morally, and biologically incoherent.
Because it killed the people running it.
It succeeded precisely by consuming and destroying the life it depended upon. Its internal order, the neat rows of cane, the detailed ledgers, the punctual shipping schedules, was built on a foundation of profound moral and biological disorder.
A death-making institution.
A death-making institution masquerading as an agricultural enterprise.
Which brings up a really terrifying logistical question for me. How do you actually keep a machine this brutal running?
It's a question of control.
Right. I mean, if you are on an island where the population of enslaved people vastly outnumbers the white owners, managers, and colonial militia, sometimes by a ratio of 10 to 1 or more, physical violence alone, a whip alone, isn't enough to sustain that system over generations.
No, it would collapse.
You can't just terrorize people 24/7 forever without the whole thing exploding. It required something deeper. It required a legal and administrative operating system to make the violence normal, structural, and inheritable.
Precisely. And that operating code, the software running the hardware of the plantation, was race.
Let's be clear about how the book defines this, because it's important.
It is crucial to understand that in this context, race was not merely biological prejudice, or a set of hostile personal beliefs, or mere bigotry. Personal prejudice alone doesn't determine complex systems of inheritance, rules of testimony, or property rights.
It's not just about people not liking each other.
No. Race was a deliberately constructed, legally codified, and politically enforced system designed specifically to stabilize property and ensure the continuity of the labor force.
I want to talk about the specific laws that enforce this, because they are horrifying. The legal doctrine that really hammers this home is called partus sequitur ventrum. The child follows the condition of the mother.
Yes, a foundational legal shift.
When you stop and think about this, it completely upended traditional European patriarchal norms. Under English common law for centuries, a child's legal status, their inheritance, their name, follow the father.
The patrilineal line.
Right. But the colonial planters deliberately changed the law purely to secure the plantation's future property.
They needed to ensure the next generation of laborers.
If the law says the child status follows the mother, then the horrific, widespread, and systemic sexual violence inflicted by white owners and overseers on enslaved black women actually resulted in the financial expansion of the owner's property.
It's an unimaginable calculation.
The system legally erased the consequences of the violence and actually capitalized on it. A child born of an owner's assault was legally his slave, ready to be put to work or sold.
It is the ultimate legal enclosure of futurity. The plantation system didn't just claim the present labor of the people it held captive through this law. It claimed generations before they were even conceived.
And they backed this up with other laws too, right? The slave codes?
Yes. To maintain this rigid racial code, colonial assemblies passed comprehensive slave codes that heavily policed every aspect of life. They policed movement, requiring passes to leave the estate. They policed assembly, banning large gatherings.
Just total control over everyday life.
And crucially, they policed testimony. The racial code legally ensured that a black person's testimony could be entirely dismissed or severely restricted in a court of law against a white person.
Meaning they had no legal voice.
This administrative rule legally shielded white violence from any consequence. If an overseer beats a worker to death and only other enslaved workers witness it, and their testimony is legally invalid, then the crime, in the eyes of the colonial state, legally does not exist.
That is just a zone of absolute impunity.
The law created exactly that.
And what's wild is that this racial code wasn't just about oppressing enslaved Africans. It was also a highly calculated tool for managing poor Europeans. The book talks about this concept of the psychological wage of whiteness.
This is a very important dynamic to grasp.
Because obviously there were poor, landless white Europeans on these islands, indentured servants who had finished their time, sailors, laborers. They had terrible lives too.
Yes, and this reveals how legal codes force populations into categories that primarily benefit capital. The poor, landless white Europeans in the Caribbean faced harsh material conditions, intense debt, and total political exclusion from the elite planter class.
So they were basically at the bottom, too.
Economically speaking, their material interests had far more in common with the enslaved workforce than with the absentee plantation owner living in a mansion.
But the planters couldn't let them realize that.
The elite planters were terrified of a unified class rebellion. So the racial code offered these poor whites a wage, not a monetary wage, but a psychological and legal one.
A status wage.
It offered them a privileged legal status strictly based on their European ancestry. It gave them presumptive freedom, the legal right to bear arms, a standing in court, and often positions in the colonial militia policing the enslaved.
So it buys their loyalty.
This wage of whiteness successfully prevented cross-racial class solidarity. It aligned the poor, disenfranchised white European with the wealthy, exploitative planter in defense of the racial order. It essentially recruited the poor to guard the wealth of the rich, ensuring the enslaved population remained isolated and surrounded.
That is incredibly manipulative. But the code was also full of glaring hypocritical contradictions, right?
Right.
I mean, if you look at the skilled enslaved workers on the estate, the head boilers, the blacksmiths, the master carpenters.
The technical experts.
Yeah, the plantation completely relied on these individuals. They trusted them with highly complex chemistry monitoring the exact crystallization point of the boiling sugar, which could ruin the whole crop if done wrong.
It was highly specialized knowledge.
They trusted them with metallurgy and repairing the steam engines and mills. Enslaved people literally ran the technical and scientific operations of the estate.
They absolutely did.
That reality completely destroyed the racist pseudoscientific claims coming out of Europe that Africans were intellectually inferior or incapable of complex thought. But the plantation machine just totally ignored that obvious truth.
It just conveniently looked the other way.
It valued their immense skill because it made money while simultaneously refusing to grant them equal humanity.
The plantation resolved that cognitive dissonance pragmatically. It recognized intelligence and skill precisely where production required it, and it ruthlessly denied equality where power required it.
So the skill just made them more valuable property.
Exactly. A highly skilled enslaved head boiler had a much higher market value on the ledger than a field hand. His skill increased his price as property, but it did not increase his recognized personhood under the law.
You know, I've heard arguments in the past, usually from older history books or apologists trying to soften this history, saying things like, well, it was a harsh system, but some planters were paternalistic.
The benevolent master myth.
Yeah, like some were kind to their workers. They provided housing and medical care. How does the source handle that kind of narrative?
The text brilliantly and systematically deconstructs the myth of benevolence. It argues that a supposedly kind or paternalistic owner still possessed the absolute, unquestioned legal power to sell a child away from its mother to settle a gambling debt.
Because they were still property.
They still possessed the power to separate a family on a whim. Furthermore, the medical care provided on the plantation was structurally compromised.
In what way?
The plantation hospital, or sick house, existed to protect the owner's investment, not to promote the worker's well-being. The doctor treated a wound or an illness so that the body could be returned as quickly as possible to the exact labor regime that caused the wound or illness in the first place.
So it's like fixing a broken tractor, not healing a patient.
Precisely. Paternalism just softened the aesthetic image of absolute power without ever surrendering its violent foundation. Having an affectionate or familiar relationship within a system of radical, legally enforced inequality does not make the institution legitimate. It just makes the violence more intimate.
Man, that is perfectly stated. It just makes the violence more intimate.
It's a stark reality.
And that absolute legal power over human beings, defining them strictly as property, unlocked the next phase of this machine. We move from the physical, muddy, bloody reality of the farm into the abstract, pristine world of paper, ledgers, and debt.
The financialization of slavery.
Right. Because the legal code made people property, it meant they could be turned into liquid financial collateral. The book calls this financing the harvest. And the core idea here is that the plantation didn't just produce sugar for the teacups of Europe, it produced a second invisible crop financial obligation.
Yes. To understand the scale of this, we have to return to that capital threshold we discussed earlier.
The massive cost of the mills and boiling houses.
Because building a sugar works was so incredibly expensive, almost all planters were heavily indebted. They needed massive capital advances from Europe just to get started.
They needed loans.
They needed credit to buy the copper vats, the iron rollers, the lumber, the provisions, and crucially, to purchase the enslaved labor force before a single cane stalk was even planted, let alone harvested and sold.
So they were in the hole from day one?
Deep in the hole. This massive need for upfront capital created immense transatlantic credit networks. You had Caribbean planters heavily tied to metropolitan merchant banks in London, Amsterdam, and Bristol. You had complex chains of credit, insurance, and consignment.
Wait, let me make sure I fully grasp the mechanics of this. What did the planters actually use as collateral to get these massive multi-year loans from banks in London? Was it just the land?
It wasn't just the land, they used human beings.
As collateral.
Because the racial slave code legally defined enslaved African people as chattel property, their physical bodies, their future labor, and crucially, their future unborn offspring, literally backed the mortgages that financed the empire.
So a bank in London would literally hold a mortgage on a person.
A bank in London would underwrite a massive loan to a planter in Jamaica, and the legal documentation would list the names, ages, and appraised values of hundreds of enslaved people as the collateral. If the planter defaulted, the bank seized the people and sold them to recoup the debt.
Human beings were the foundational financial instruments of early global capitalism.
Yes, human collateral was the bedrock.
That is just staggering to think about the paperwork for that just
Yeah.
sitting in some archive in London right now. And this setup leads directly to what the book calls the debt spiral, because farming is unpredictable, right?
Highly unpredictable.
What happens if there's a bad harvest? Say a hurricane hits Barbados, or there's a terrible drought, the sugar yield drops, the planter's revenue plummets.
But the debt doesn't go away.
Right. The creditor sitting in an office in London doesn't care about the weather. They demand their repayment with interest. So the planter has to borrow even more money just to survive to the next season, which means higher interest rates and deeper debt.
And the consequences fall on the workforce.
And how does the planter solve this? By squeezing the collateral. That financial pressure on a ledger in Europe translates directly into intensified physical violence on the ground in the Caribbean.
To squeeze out more output to pay the mounting interest, the planter reduces the food rations for the enslaved workers. He extends the working hours deeper into the night. He pushes the overseers to use the whip more frequently to speed up the gangs.
So Wall Street logic dictated the violence.
Financial time in London completely dictated biological time in the Caribbean.
It perfectly illustrates how geographical and administrative distance creates moral dilution. I mean, the financial architecture allowed an investor, a banker, or an absentee plantation owner living a life of high society in London to fully participate in the profits of slavery without ever having to witness the brutality of it.
They were completely insulated.
They received these clean, leather-bound paper ledgers detailing yields per acre, depreciation of assets, and annual returns. The paperwork totally abstracted the violence. The absentee owner never heard the screams of a worker caught in the mill. They just saw a neat column of numbers indicating a slight dip in expected profit.
And we really have to re-examine how this entire financial system defined the concept of risk.
How so?
From the standpoint of the insurance broker in London or the absentee planter, if a slave revolt occurred, or if a group of enslaved people successfully escaped to the mountains, that event was calculated and recorded purely as a financial risk or a loss of property.
But to the enslaved people themselves?
A revolt was a profound assertion of their humanity and a desperate fight for liberation. The world of finance translated human struggles for freedom into mere mathematical variables affecting a quarterly return on investment.
Wow. So if we follow the logic of the balance sheet, the enslaved workers were basically treated as creditors, but they were unpaid creditors.
That framing the enslaved as the ultimate unpaid creditors of the modern world is a very powerful and accurate way to read Dr. Saheli's analysis.
I mean, they advanced everything to the estate. They advanced their grueling physical labor, their health, their families, their children, and their very lives to the plantation, day in and day out. They funded the entire operation with their bodies.
And received nothing in return.
But the legal and financial hierarchy completely erased their claim. They were at the absolute bottom. Actually, they were beneath the bottom of the balance sheet. They weren't even recognized as having a claim to the wealth they generated.
The enslaved workforce advanced the fundamental capacity that allowed the entire Atlantic system to generate unprecedented wealth, yet the legal and financial systems resolutely refused to recognize that profound debt.
And this glaring intentional omission peaked, incredibly hypocritically, during British emancipation in the 1830s. I'm so glad we were talking about this because this part always blows my mind.
It's a crucial historical moment.
When slavery was legally abolished in the British Empire, the government paid out massive financial compensation, but they didn't pay the enslaved people for generations of stolen labor, stolen lives, and stolen wealth. They paid the owners.
That is correct. The British government took out one of the largest loans in its history to pay the equivalent of billions of dollars in today's money, but they paid it entirely to the slave owners as compensation for the loss of their property.
The government essentially socialized the cost of ending the violence, and they gave the massive financial payout to the perpetrators.
Exactly right. The state recognized the financial injury to the owner's portfolio, but it completely ignored the massive accumulated moral and economic claims of the millions of people who had actually been owned and exploited.
It's just unbelievable.
It is the ultimate historical proof of how the financial system protected the claims of capital and property over the claims of human life and justice. The displaced balance sheet remained firmly in place even in the moment of legal emancipation.
And all of these massive financial debts, all this capital swirling around, required a constantly expanding market to pay it all off. You can't just sell sugar as a rare spice anymore if you have this level of debt. You need everyone to consume it all the time.
Mass consumption became a systemic necessity.
Which brings us back across the ocean to the rapidly industrializing cities of Europe. In this next phase, we see sugar transition from being this elite, sculpted luxury for aristocrats into an absolute biological necessity for the working class.
The timing of this transition is critical to understand the global metabolic shift. As the Caribbean plantations were expanding and churning out massive volumes of sugar, European cities were undergoing the violent disruption of the Industrial Revolution.
People moving from farms to cities.
Millions of people were moving from rural agricultural lives into urban slums and massive factories. Factory work completely reorganized human time. Workers were no longer subject to the rising and setting of the sun or the seasons.
They were ruled by the clock.
They were subject to factory bells, strict clocks, and the relentless mechanical pace of the power loom or the steam engine. The work was exhausting, the wages were abysmal, and they needed cheap, fast energy just to survive the shift.
Right, because you can't exactly take a leisurely 2-hour lunch break to eat a hearty stew when you are chained to a textile loom for 14 hours a day in a factory in Manchester. You need calories and you need them instantly.
Exactly. and sugar enter the European working class diet seamlessly to fill this exact void. When sugar was combined with the newly affordable bitter stimulants flowing in from other parts of the empire, tea from India and China, coffee or cocoa, it created a potent, hot, calorie-dense, stimulating drink.
The perfect fuel for a worker.
It was the perfect fuel for factory time. It suppressed the pangs of hunger. It provided a rapid spike of glucose energy to tired muscles. The caffeine provided a stimulant kick, and the warmth offered a brief, fleeting moment of comfort in a freezing, exhausting, miserable day.
It also became this crucial domestic technology for working-class women, right? They used cheap sugar to make jams, preserves, and treacle.
A way to preserve calories.
Yeah, this allowed them to stretch their incredibly meager household budgets. You could take cheap, stale, dark bread that tasted like cardboard, spread highly sweetened jam on it, and suddenly it was palatable. It was a cheap way to feed a family when meat or fresh vegetables were entirely out of reach.
It masked the poverty of the diet.
And then the book talks about the rise of modern advertising, which deliberately created what it calls the purchasable moment. They started aggressively linking the consumption of sweetness to concepts of childhood care, reward, and respectability.
Marketing emotion.
Exactly. A cheat penny sweet wasn't just a candy. It was a way for a desperately poor mother to show her child a tiny bit of love and indulgence when she couldn't afford a toy or new clothes.
The cultural engineering of demand is profound here. But we must analytically contrast these two working classes, separated by an ocean but bound by the commodity.
How do you mean?
You have the industrial factory worker in Europe, deeply exploited, using cheap colonial sugar just to briefly endure the miseries of the factory floor. And across the Atlantic, you have the Caribbean agricultural worker enduring the unspeakable miseries of the plantation just to provide that cheap sugar.
So they're connected by this cycle of exploitation.
The global capitalist system essentially pitted the deprived, hungry industrial worker against the enslaved agricultural worker. The survival of one was predicated on the brutal exploitation of the other.
When you lay it out like that, it feels like we, or rather historical narratives, just keep blaming the consumer for having a sweet tooth. We say, oh, people just love sugar. Is it fair to say the market just organically gave people what they naturally wanted?
Dr. Savely's source material explicitly rejects that consumer as scapegoat narrative. Mass demand for sugar did not just naturally exist in a vacuum. It was deliberately cultivated, reliably supplied, subsidized by state violence, and culturally normalized by a massive institutional system that absolutely needed to sell massive volumes of the product to survive its own overleveraged debt structures.
So they manufactured the demand because they had to pay their debts.
Precisely. The brilliant trick of the system was that the individual mouth, the consumer's diet, became the site of moral judgment. In the 19th century, elites blamed the poor for their bad diets and rotting teeth. Today, we blame people for their lack of willpower.
We make it a personal failing.
The blame is always individualized onto the consumer, while the massive, powerful institutions that engineer the cheapness, availability, and necessity of sugar completely retain their innocence.
And meanwhile, while all this wealth and cheap energy is flowing into Europe, back in the Caribbean, the societies are experiencing what the book calls emancipation without deplantation.
Yes. Legal slavery ended in the British Caribbean in the 1830s. And make no mistake, that was a profound, hard-won rupture. It meant people could no longer be legally bought and sold on an auction block.
But the underlying system didn't change.
The underlying physical and economic structures of the plantation remained completely intact. The land, the milling infrastructure, the intergenerational wealth, and the local political power remained heavily consolidated in the exact same hands of the former white owners.
So you're legally free, but you have no land and no money.
The formerly enslaved population entered into a state of legal freedom, but because they had been systematically denied any access to land or capital, they were economically coerced into working for starvation wages on the exact same estates they had just been freed from.
Trapped by economics instead of laws.
The whip was legally abolished, but the threat of starvation replaced it as the tool of labor discipline.
Which sets the stage for a massive flashpoint a century later, the Buckley's Uprising of 1935 in St. Kitts.
Buckley's is a pivotal watershed moment in Caribbean history. In 1935, during the crushing depths of the Great Depression, the plantation owners in St. Kitts refused to pay a decent wage. The cane cutters, who had endured generations of this structural poverty, had enough.
They went on strike.
They demanded fair wages. And when they were flatly refused, they didn't just walk off one estate. They marched across the island extending their strike from plantation to plantation.
That takes incredible coordination.
They fundamentally transformed the cane field. It was no longer just a site of exploited agricultural labor. They turned it into a site of organized, mass political agency. They shut the machine down.
And how did the authorities respond?
Despite being violently suppressed by colonial armed forces, people were shot and killed. This uprising birthed modern labor politics, trade unionism, and the anti-colonial movement in the region.
A real turning point.
It was the moment the descendants of the plantation majority began to actively remake the nation, stepping onto the historical stage to demand full democratic citizenship and a living wage.
But the story of sugar in St. Kitts, and really across much of the Caribbean, doesn't end with a neat, victorious bow. The state-run sugar industry in St. Kitts actually formally closed operations fairly recently, in 2005. The last cane was cut, the mills went quiet.
The physical infrastructure finally stopped.
Right. But the book argues that the legacy of the plantation didn't vanish when the factory doors locked. It just changed shape. It moved inward. It moved off the landscape and directly into the human body. This brings us to the final and perhaps most immediately relevant part of the research, the metabolic afterlife.
The metabolic afterlife is a conceptual tool used to trace the direct, unbroken institutional continuity from the colonial plantation era to the modern public health crisis.
Okay, break that down for us.
Centuries of export monoculture. The system where you devote all the best, most fertile land on an island entirely to sugar for export completely destroyed local food sovereignty. It destroyed the knowledge and the infrastructure for feeding the local population with locally grown nutritious food.
Because they only grew sugar.
Consequently, when the sugar industry finally collapsed, the Caribbean had transitioned from a society that produced sweetness for global export to a society that was highly dependent on imported, heavily processed, shelf-stable foods loaded with cheap, free sugars and industrial fats.
So they were forced to buy the worst kind of food.
They were locked into a global food system designed for corporate profit, not human nutrition.
So we've gone from the violent physical coercion of producing the raw sugar to being captive consumers of the heavily processed industrial version of it. And the bodies of the people living in these post-colonial spaces are paying the ultimate price.
A devastating health price.
We are looking at absolute crises of chronic non-communicable diseases, skyrocketing rates of type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular issues, severe hypertension. The hospitals are full of the consequences of this diet.
And this brings us full circle to the displaced balance sheet. Just as the 19th century system blamed the working class consumer for their poor diet, modern medicine and public health campaigns often treat these dietary diseases strictly as a failure of individual willpower.
Like, you need to eat better.
You need to exercise more. You need to make better choices. This hyper-individualized medical model completely ignores the centuries of deliberate institutional design.
It ignores the history that created the situation.
It ignores the historical land dispossession that destroyed local agriculture. It ignores the modern commercial food engineering that surrounds people with cheap, toxic calories. The burden of this history is entirely individualized and pushed onto the patient.
So the system gets away with it again.
As Dr. Saley powerfully puts it, the human body itself, the diabetic body, the hypertensive body, is now carrying the final unresolved balance sheet of the empire.
That is heavy, the body carrying the balance sheet of the empire. Which brings us to the final conclusion of the book, The Need for Reparative Accounting. It's time to reopen the historical ledger. And what I found so powerful and actually quite hopeful is this concept of deplantation.
It's a very constructive framework.
It's not just about looking backward or feeling guilty or arguing over apologies. It is a positive, forward-looking transformation. It's about fundamentally democratizing the land.
Changing how the land is used.
Right. It's about restoring local food systems so communities can feed themselves with dignity. It's about reclaiming public health from corporate food monopolies. It's about redesigning our systems so that agriculture and finance actually serve human life rather than mindlessly consuming it for a profit margin.
That vision returns us to the core standard of life coherence. It is vital to state that sweetness itself is not inherently evil. Glucose is a biologically essential fuel for the human brain.
We're wired to like it.
The taste of sweetness belongs deeply to human memory, to cultural celebration, to hospitality, and to care. The ultimate goal of deplantation is not to banish sweetness.
Then what is it?
It is to decouple the joy and the biological pleasure of sweetness from the hidden, violent institutional condition of sacrifice. It is the demand that our global institutions, our supply chains, and our food systems must finally be made accountable to the life they organize.
Wow. Okay. I want to sincerely thank you for coming on this intense, complex journey with us today. We have traced the sugar crystal from ancient botanical roots in New Guinea through the terrifying, brutal efficiency of the Caribbean plantation machine.
It's quite a journey.
We followed it through the cold, sanitized ledgers of London financiers, right into the teacups of the Industrial Revolution, and finally into our modern diets and our very metabolisms. I think it's safe to say you will likely never look at a sugar packet or a candy bar the same way again.
Probably not.
But I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you go about your day. Look around your home, your office, your life right now. Sugar was the pioneer of this system. It laid the blueprint. But it certainly isn't the only commodity built on a displaced balance sheet.
Absolutely not.
Think about the cobalt mine in the Congo that is sitting inside the lithium battery of the smartphone or laptop you're using to listen to this right now. Or think about the incredibly cheap, fast fashion hanging in your closet, stitched together in a sweatshop thousands of miles away. What modern, everyday pleasures, conveniences, and technologies are we enjoying right this very second, simply because a massive, highly sophisticated institutional machine has successfully hidden the true cost of their harvest from our view? Keep asking questions, keep looking behind the crystal, and keep diving deep. See you next time on The Deep Dive.